Hey, this is Matt Hawkins, and you're listening to the Top Cow Chronology Project.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm Jace. This is another Top Cow Thursday episode. It's another installment of the Top Cow Chronology Project. And as I mentioned on the last show, we've come to the point in the chronology where we're covering some of the early issues of Witchblade. And just real quick, for those not familiar with the chronology, always wanted to read the Top Cow Artifact Universe books. I'm a huge Michael Turner fan. He's one of my favorite comic artists of all time. You know, he's the one that started as the initial artist on Witchblade. I had this huge omnibus. I'd never read it. Big fan of Top Cow, came around into it kind of from the backside with some of the Minotaur books, Think Tank, and met Matt Hawkins, and just a huge fan. And like, man, I need to read that omnibus. I need to get back to that Artifact Universe corner of Top Cow, which I've always wanted to read and never have. Witchblade, Darkness, all that kind of stuff. I stumble across a reading order on the Comic Vine website from a user who goes by the name of Condor. And what was really interesting about the reading order is it wasn't laid out in the order that the books had been published, but rather in the order that they should be read historically. And by that, I mean the first books in the chronology were the ones that took place the furthest in the past. So ancient Egypt and such, and then moving forward through time. But when Manny and I started to do this, we decided, well, let's read the first arc of Witchblade just to give ourselves some context, because neither one of us at that point had read any of the Artifact corner of the Top Cow universe. We'd read none of the books from that part of Top Cow. So we decided, even though it's jumping forward in the chronology, let's read those to give a little bit of a baseline. And then we'll go back to the chronology and we'll read in order. So now we've gotten to the point where we're supposed to read these Witchblade, or the point in the chronology where these Witchblade books take place again. And we didn't necessarily want to talk about them again because they, you know, our first initial reactions are what we recorded. It's what the chronology project's all about, right? Read the book and then immediately podcast about it so you get our initial reactions. Obviously, we've read these books before, and plus we're just more familiar with that part of the Top Cow universe just from being Top Cow fans for such a long time and getting to know Matt Hawkins and Mark Silvestri and all those great people over there. But I didn't just want to skip over it entirely. Still wanted to mention it, still wanted to go back and read them and give my thoughts. I think there's still some value to it going back and looking at it a few years later after we started the chronology project. So last episode, I did the first four issues. This episode's going to be a little shorter. I'm just going to cover the next two, which is 5 and 6. And then the next time I do a chronology, Top Cow chronology episode, we'll do 7 and 8. And hopefully Manny will be able to join me for that. And it'll just be kind of a good kind of refresher and put a little bow on this section of the chronology and move forward into more modern stuff and things that we haven't read before. So that's kind of where we are with that. And before I talk about these two issues I'm going to talk about tonight, Witchblade 5 and 6, I want to thank all you listeners out there who have supported the Jeremy Dale Kickstarter for the Skyward Omnibus. As of Wednesday, February 21st, might even have been very late Tuesday, February 20th, the Kickstarter has been funded. It's been completely funded. So that's huge news. It means that the omnibus is going to be created. I'll be able to have it on my bookshelf, and so will you if you've pledged. So as of this recording, it's actually at 103%. There are some stretch goals at $21,000. Kelly is going to release the omnibus digitally, which is just awesome, right? So you can, you know, still have the great looking hardcover omnibus on your bookshelf, but you can have digital files to take with you on your tablet or your phone or however you read your comics digitally. So that's really awesome. For $23,000, she will do a special cover for the omnibus. And if we hit that stretch goal, she's probably going to run like a poll and find out, do people want to have like spot gloss? Do they want to have it foil stamped? So that could be really amazing. The third stretch goal that she's announced is the one I really would like to see happen. It's $26,000. So it's basically 130% of the original amount. And there's 14 days left, so there's plenty of time to get there. But if the Kickstarter does reach 26,000, she's going to release issue 10 as a single issue. And that to me would just be amazing, because it's one thing to have this omnibus that has the first 9 issues that got published and to be able to, you know, have the complete story in one volume, but to be able to have a single issue, especially if you own issues 1 through 9, I mean, that's just incredible. So I've mentioned before recently that Kelly has dropped the price on some of the tiers for a lot of the ultimate packages, where you can have basically all the original art from a single issue. That's at $2,500 now. So if you're a collector of original art, I mean, you would, if you went out and tried to buy all the original art for a single comic issue, it's going to cost you a lot more than that. You know, individually, you're going to pay, even if you're paying $200 a page, that's like $4,000. And you're going to pay a lot more than $200 for splash pages and what have you, just depending on the artist. So that's a heck of a deal. There's a lot of other tiers and options available. There's the Jeremy Dale original art tier, where you can get 3 sketches from when he's plotting and character design and such. It's only $150. It's a great deal. So I encourage you, if you have not yet gone and pledged, please do so. And if you have pledged already, maybe go back and take a second look at some of the other tiers that have been added, and maybe you want to make an adjustment. So thanks for everyone's patience while I've been promoting this. You know, Jeremy was a friend, somebody that I cared about a lot, and I really am glad to see that this Kickstarter is funded. It's honoring his memory, and it's an incredible story. I mean, $50 for this omnibus, and you can have it forever. You can, you know, share it with your kids. Makes a great bedtime story, as I've said. So I'm going to go ahead and play that same snippet I've been playing on the podcast for a while now, just in case someone's listening for the first time. You can get some details on what the Kickstarter is all about. I encourage you, if you want to know even more, to go back and listen to the special we did, Kelly and I together, talking about Jeremy and his legacy and his love of comics and what the Skyward story is all about. So I'm going to go ahead and play that for you now.
Well, you mentioned Skyward. I mentioned it as well. You know, I've talked about it on the other podcast, but maybe some of our listeners aren't that familiar. So why don't you tell them what Skyward's all about?
Sure. For those of you that don't know, Skyward is one of those all ages, light fantasy adventure about a boy and his dog that need to unite the entire world against the dark army of the Brother Kings. If you like things like Legends of Zelda or like Lord of the Rings, it's right up your alley. This is a little less like adult than something like Game of Thrones.
Why don't you let us know what this Kickstarter that you have going, and there will be a link in the show notes and all this information, everyone, so don't worry. But why don't you tell us, Kelly, what the Kickstarter is actually going to be funding?
Okay, so because we're talking Skyward, Jeremy created Skyward to be an ongoing series. I mean, he had this sucker planned out until at least issue 50. And it kind of saddens me that you guys don't get to see what his grand idea was. But he left issue 9 on such a cliffhanger that I felt like it was my responsibility as his good wife, as well as a fan of Skyward, to at least bring out an issue 10. So that way it will give us all a little bit of closure. Now, it doesn't actually end the series. So in your imagination, you can keep it going. And if I ever decide to do anything with it later in maybe another medium, then I can. But this will give all the fans a little bit of closure. So issue 10 is going to be a 32-page issue. I took Jeremy's ideas for issue 10, and I went to our friend Barbara Kessel, the comic writer and editor, and she actually developed a script that works. And then Shannon Gallant, amazing man that he is, also a G.I. Joe artist, drew the entire issue. And now it's at The Colors with Catherine Leno and Laura Martin. And what I decided to do was, I don't want there just to be an issue 10 and that's it. So I did a Kickstarter for the Jeremy Dale Skyward Omnibus. So that omnibus is going to cover issues 1 through 9, plus you'll get issue 10 in there. And you're going to get all of the variant cover arts by all the different artists Jeremy had, such as Phil Noto, Darwin Cook, Stefan Rue, Tom Zoller, Mike Norton, David Peterson. I mean, it's a huge list.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about kind of the business end of Kickstarter, because I know people sometimes don't realize the way that it works. And, you know, even though it's only been a week or so and it's already at 57%, I know a lot of times there's a lot of excitement early on and you know, it gets to 80 or 90% and it kind of dies out. So if you're planning on pledging, do it sooner than later, because it doesn't get produced unless it gets to 100%. So,
yeah. Well, and I'm glad that you brought this up, because some people don't realize when it comes to Kickstarter, you can pledge whatever you want. Like, you can do an incentive. Your card, your credit card, is not charged until we hit our end date, which is March 8th. And if we hit the 100%, if we hit that $20,000 or we're above it. So if you're thinking about, well, I would really like to donate or do an incentive, but I don't get paid until next week, that's fine. Just go ahead and grab the incentive, especially if it's one of the ones that there's only one of. Grab it now. You're not going to actually be charged until March 8th.
Yeah, and it's so easy. We're all so busy. It's so easy to forget. So do it. Do it. Open another tab right now while you're listening to this, or if you're in the car, you know, as soon as you get where you're going, as soon as you finish listening to the podcast. Yeah. Don't get on your phone while you're driving, but yeah, do it sooner than later, because it's really easy to forget. So,
And truthfully, the reception has been amazing so far, and the outpouring of love and support has been amazing. But until we hit this 20,000, even though I'm very confident that we will, I'm gonna still be like a little anxious and freaking out. So please don't let Kelly freak out.
All right, now on to the books for this episode, starting with Witchblade number 5 from May 1996. Writers David Wall and Christina Z. Also, Michael Turner has a credit as a writer. Pencils are by Michael Turner, inks are by D-Tron, and colors are by Jonathan D. Smith. So if you remember last time, we left off with Sarah showing up at her new partner Jake's apartment in the middle of the night, looking pretty beat up from her battle at the Statue of Liberty. And this one picks up with Jake making her breakfast. And then we get a scene of Sarah still laying in bed with the Witchblade on her hand. And she's kind of, I don't know if she's dreaming or she just has her eyes closed and she's thinking, and she's basically kind of going over the craziness that's happened to her over the last few issues, the last few days of her life and her timeline, so to speak. And then we see Jake come and kind of knock on the door. Hey, Pez, you awake? And Sarah opens her eyes and she's got the Witchblade on. She's got the sheet pulled up over her. And as Jake opens the door, we see the Witchblade kind of collapse and retract itself from her hand into just a little bracelet on her wrist. And as Jake is about to serve her breakfast in bed, because so far in just the first four issues, it's pretty obvious that Jake has some pretty strong emotional and romantic feelings toward Sarah. And she's supposed to be a pretty good cop. You think she'd pick up on it, but she doesn't really seem to yet. But anyway, Jake is pretty shocked by Sarah's appearance. He says, "Well, Sarah, look at your face." And she says, "You don't have to rub it in, Jake." And he's like, "No, I mean, you've recovered so quickly. What happened?" And she feels her face and she says, "Oh yeah, I'm a really quick healer, but obviously it's has more to do with the Witchblade than any of Sarah's inherent healing abilities." So she comes out of the room. She's dressed in some of Jake's clothes and kind of makes fun of his taste. And Sarah does apologize for imposing on Jake, and Jake makes it apparent that she can impose anytime. And as she leaves, he mentions that they need to talk and it's about work. And Sarah says, sure, we'll talk soon. And as she leaves, Jake noticed that the chain lock on his door is broken, and perhaps that's how Ken Irons got in. We saw him kind of watching over Sarah as she slept in the end of last issue. On the next page, we see someone talking. We're not exactly sure who it is. It's a bunch of word balloons and some pipes that clearly are sending water through. There's some noises and sound effects that make us believe that. And then as we turn the page, we see that Nottingham is dressed in this skin-tight black leotard with kind of a gas mask over his mouth. And the water pipes that we're seeing are leading right up to the mask and goes over his mouth. So basically, he's being waterboarded by Ken Irons. And Ken isn't very happy with Nottingham's behavior at the Statue of Liberty, how he was threatening to kill Sarah and looked like he had every intention of killing Sarah and taking the power of the Witchblade for himself, because we learned in the first four issues that there's nothing that Ken Irons wants more than to control the Witchblade. Knowing that he's male and he's unable to, he's simply going to have to settle for controlling the person that wields the Witchblade. So as we turn the page, we see that Lisa, Sarah's young neighbor, whose mother was killed before the series even started, and that had to do with things that Sarah was doing in the first issue. We see she's visiting a modeling agency, and she goes back behind the scenes. And I don't know, I always felt like this underlying plot thread of Lisa being a model, and it just seems really strange in this first volume. I mean, we don't really get to see where it goes in the first eight issues, but I remember reading it the first time and just thinking it's almost an excuse for Michael Turner to draw like women. And maybe this is where the cheesecake connotation of Witchblade came in, but it's just, I don't know. It just seems a little strange and a little out of place. But anyway, as Lisa's getting a tour of this modeling agency, she meets the famous a woman who is actually in charge of the modeling agency, Ms. Boucher. And she basically gets recruited on the spot to be a model. So it's like, yeah, she came in to kind of find out what it's all about. They're kind of being nice and showing her around. And all of a sudden, she's in. So again, the whole subplot seems a little strange. And the fact that there are subplots does make this feel a little 80s, 90s-ish, which, you know, that's the time period it came out. So that's a nice throwback, a nice bit of nostalgia that everything is not wrapped up in, you know, nice, neat five or six story blocks. There's underlying threads. But again, that one just seems a little weird. So I'm sure maybe it has to do with the serial killer who's killing those beautiful women. Maybe that's how it'll tie in. Just not really sure. As we move on to the next page, we see that Nottingham and Ken Irons are having lunch with somebody, and I think it's supposed to be Sting from the police, and they're talking about a fundraiser that's going on, and apparently earlier this fundraiser had contacted Irons about making a donation, and he said he would donate $250,000, and so they're talking about making the donation, and Irons actually asks Nottingham, yeah, you were tied up, you know, quote unquote, tied up in my office while I was on the phone. And, you know, clearly this is when he was in the skin tight outfit with the water being forced down his throat. And anyway, Ken Irons says, you know, you were in the office, you overheard, how much did I say? And Nottingham says, I believe it was an even $2 million just to kind of get back at Irons. And Irons, he kind of coughs and says, $2 it is. He can't really back down at that point. He's going to look like a cheapskate in front of Sting. So just kind of a interesting character moment that they put in here about the tension between Irons and Nottingham. You know, early on, it seemed like Nottingham was basically his right hand yes man. And then as the series has progressed, we see that Nottingham really has ideas of his own and he sees himself much more as an equal, whereas Iron seems like the more powerful of the two, but there's clearly a power struggle going on. And it almost seems like they're both trying to use each other. They both want the Witchblade for different reasons and in different ways. And so it's like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but in reality there's no love lost between them. So as we turn the page, we see that Sarah is actually showing up at the Irons International Investment and Holdings building. And she basically wants to snoop around and get some information about Ken Irons and find out why he sent her flowers when she was in the hospital and why he showed up at the gym, the boxing gym where she was working out. So as she's kind of snooping around, she goes walking by a meeting room that Ken Irons is in. And as soon as she walks by, he immediately looks at her. So there may be something going on there. He can sense the Witchblade or some kind of connection. And she gets spooked and she leaves. And then we turn the page and we see that it's in the subway now. And we find another one of those women who are kneeling, head thrown back, frozen position, microwave from the inside out. And there's some dialogue boxes on the page talking about how in New York you can kill even in broad daylight, even when there's innocent bystanders standing by because everyone tries to keep to themselves. So again, it's a plot thread from the first issue, the serial killer that's going around murdering these women, but we really don't have any more detail than that so far. Next, we see Sarah's at the police station and she's doing research on Ken Irons at the computer. And this really didn't make much sense to me. Okay. Like she's trying to get information about Ken Irons. She goes to his building. She snoops around during the day while people are there and everything and, you know, and then gets spooked and leaves right away and then goes and looks him up on the computer. It seems like it should have gone the other way around, right? Like, I don't know. Maybe it's just because of the time that I'm currently living in, you know, like, of course I would research anything on the computer first before I went somewhere and did it, as opposed to in 1996, that maybe wasn't quite the case. You know, things weren't so readily available online. So maybe that's just my own temporal bias, I guess you'd say. But anyway, as Sarah's there researching Ken and reading about him, she falls asleep and she has a dream. And she's kind of walking through doorways, long hallway with a bunch of doors, kind of looks like the Matrix. And one of the doors opens and it's the woman from the nightclub that got microwaved from the inside out with the polka dot dress. Another door is showing the Witchblade symbols that were kind of tattooed or branded onto the back of Nottingham's hand in issue 3. And then another door opens and it's Nottingham himself with a sword slung over his back and kind of a cloak wrapped around him. And Sarah holds up her hand as if she's holding a gun. And a gun immediately appears and she's dressed in the same outfit she was in when she went to bust the drug dealers in the first issue. So they start talking about the Witchblade and Nottingham says to forgive him for not being able to complete his assignment. He wasn't able to end her life and set her free from the consequences of the Witchblade. And he seems to... There seems to be a connection there. He starts talking about what they've found together and it must never... And then he wakes up saying, stop! In a... what I perceive to be a cold sweat. So that's how the issue ends. Clearly, there's some kind of connection between Nottingham and Sarah, and it almost seems like it could be some kind of a budding romance or a romantic connection. So again, we wonder about the history of this Nottingham character. I find him to be much more interesting than Irons in general. All right, so let's move on to issue 6. Well, you know, before I do that, let me just talk a little about issue 5. You know, there were a few of the issues between 1 and 4 that when I went through and read it back, there were things I noticed or things incidents that happened or some scripting that I didn't notice the first time, or at least I don't remember noticing the first time. And I've mentioned those on the previous podcast. For issue 5, there wasn't really anything there that was new. I feel like the first time I read it, I got everything there was to get. You know, there's a few funny lines between Irons and Nottingham and little one-liners here and there. You know, like when they're at the restaurant with Sting. I don't know that I thought that much about the backwards research of Sarah, you know, going to the place first and then looking online. But again, I may just not have realized the temporal bias that I brought to that until just now as I was analyzing the issue. But for the most part, it's not that it's a bad issue at all. It's a pretty solid issue. It advances the story very well. There's some, you know, beautiful Michael Turner art, but it's there's not much action in it. You know, there's no fights. There's no kind of in your face that like we saw in issue 4. So it's very much kind of a setup issue, really, for issue 7 and 8, more so than even issue 6. Issue 6 is advancing the plot as well. It has a little bit of action in it, but you know, by no means was 5 a bad issue. I really enjoyed it because, as I said, it is advancing the narrative, and a lot of what we're learning is incidental to the character moments, and seeing things like Sarah and Jake interacting and the Witchblade being able to retract itself into a bracelet, and the moments between Nottingham and Irons. It's the first time where we really feel like they really are at odds in a way, and they're only working together out of convenience, but it's a tenuous relationship at best. And yet Irons has something over him. I mean, Nottingham, from everything we saw in the first 4 issues, is a very capable and powerful fighter. And I don't know if he allowed himself to be placed in that situation where he was waterboarded. We did see Irons beat him pretty badly in issue 4 at the Statue of Liberty, you know, whispering, "You got to let this happen so she doesn't catch on that we're together." So I just wondered, did he get imprisoned and chained up for this torture before he regained consciousness? I mean, it's never really explained, but what is clear from issue 5 is that, yes, they are at odds. They do have similar goals in that they seem to want to somehow control or contain or have dominion over the power of the Witchblade, but they both know that they themselves cannot wield it. And so it seems like they each have a different plan or idea of how they're going to either control the Witchblade by controlling Sarah or just stealing the actual power from the artifact and leaving the artifact an empty husk, I guess. So yeah, issue 5, there's a lot to unpack there. It's just not heavy on the action. So moving on to issue 6, once again, writers, we have Michael Turner, David Wall, and Christina Z. Pencils by Mike Turner, inks by D-Tron, and colors by Jonathan D. Smith. So issue 6 picks up with the funeral of Sarah's partner. This is the Michael Yee, who died at the end of issue 1. So we see the appropriate flag draped over the casket and the policemen lined up in ranks, many of them in their dress blues. And again, we have this part of the comic. It's a little bit of its time. It's kind of now it's all done on the inside of the front cover with a couple paragraphs kind of catching everybody up. But in the older comics, it was done through exposition, so thought bubbles or one character talking to another. In this case, it's dialogue boxes with a close-up of Sarah. And she's, again, thinking about everything she's been going through and about the dream that she just had about Nottingham. And mixed in with that is the regret that she feels for losing her partner. And, you know, she just feels guilty, basically. It's a little bit of survivor's guilt. So as the funeral ends, we see the different officers start to drift off. And Seltzer, the IA officer, makes a typical creepy jerk comment about how Sarah looks really great for all her injuries that she's sustained lately, and she must have some rejuvenation secrets, and she probably should have shared them with her partner. Maybe he'd still be alive. I mean, the guy's just a dick. I mean, why would you say that? Like, there's no reason to even think to say that. But Sarah calls him on it and basically tells him to get out of her face. And then the captain comes over and kind of steers her away from him. Meanwhile, Jake shows up and sidles up next to Seltzer. And before he can even say anything, Seltzer starts talking about what a nice outfit she's wearing. And again, just no reason to say that. And Jake's not having any of it. Really not having any of it. And Seltzer then says something even about Jake's being attracted to Sarah. And Jake almost loses it. Just about punches him out, but decides in the end that Seltzer's not worth his time. So meanwhile, Sarah decides to walk home to clear her head. But before she gets home, she decides to stop for a coffee at a little coffee boutique. And as she's sitting there thinking about the dream and Nottingham, somebody actually shows up to give her a cup of coffee, and she looks up, and sure enough, it's Ken Irons. And he says he wants to express his condolences. He saw her leaving the cemetery. He read about her losing her partner in the paper. And we know these are all, you know, flowery lies from Irons. And Sarah even says, "Have you been following me?" And Irons then kind of turns the tables on her and says, "Well, I seem to recall seeing you doing some investigative work at my office." And Sarah said, "Oh, well, you did give me your card." She's like, "Actually, I went up there. I wanted to talk about what happened on Liberty Island." And Irons doesn't miss a beat. And he says, "Yeah, how is the Witchblade treating you?" And Sarah's shocked. She's like, "What? You know? How do you know? Like, what's going on?" And Irons says, "You know, I have the answers. If you can come with me, I'll fill you in, basically." And so Irons wants to take her in his limo. She says, "You know, I've had bad experience with limos lately. You know, she got kidnapped previously in issue 3. And so they decided to take a cab. Meanwhile, Jake has been keeping tabs on her as well, I'm sure because he's worried. But still, Jake, that's stalking, brother. And he says to himself, "Kenneth Irons, Sarah, what are you getting yourself into?" So then the scene shifts to outside Sarah's apartment. We see somebody trying to pick her lock. It turns out it's her sister, Julie. And Lisa comes in and introduces herself. They have a couple drinks, despite the fact that Lisa's underage. And we find out that Julie's a model, modeling for Boucher. And apparently, you know, Julie's a model as well and kind of knows that world. And so after their drink, apparently they're going to go out on the town. So then we see Kenneth Irons' apartment. He starts filling in Sarah on what exactly the Witchblade is. And he basically tells her that it's up to her what she wants to do, but he can help her control it or perhaps remove it. What isn't at all made clear by him is why he would be wanting to help her. He just says, you know, he's a businessman. His father was an archaeologist. And he learned about the Witchblade. And it's connected to a number of, you know, historic events where the supernatural occurred. And he clearly collects antiquities. But again, it's not clear why he would be willing to help her. So he goes and he shows Sarah all the artifacts and he says, "It's basically up to you. It's up to you to decide whether this is the life you want to lead, the life wearing the Witchblade, or if not, I can help you remove it." And then we get a glimpse into just how manipulative he can be as we get the dialogue boxes where he's thinking. And he talks about the fact that he just wants to start the procedure now and, you know, take what he wants and get it over with. And he's just ready. It's right there within his reach. But then he thinks better. He second guesses himself and says, "You know, I'm a businessman. I've waited this long. I can wait a little longer." the time isn't quite right yet. And he says he's getting a phone call and he must show Sarah the door. So then the scene shifts back to the subway, where previously we saw the latest victim of this microwave view from the inside out killer. And Jake is doing some investigating when a reporter shows up, actually. She says her name is Becca. She works for WGOR Channel 81, and she knows a lot about the Rialto fiasco. She knows about all the cons that died there. And she knows why the police tape hasn't been broken, and knows something about these recent murders as well. And Jake seems intrigued and says, tell me more. Meanwhile, Kenneth Irons has walked Sarah to Central Park and says he'll leave her until tomorrow, when he'll hopefully get Sarah's decision. Sarah thanks him for the information and says that she will walk home through the park rather than letting Irons hail her a cab. And as she's walking through the park, lo and behold, but who shows up other than Nottingham? So she fires a few shots at him. He manages to dodge them and kind of tackles her and says, I don't want to fight. She's not having any of it. Kicks him where it really hurts. And he disappears and then reappears behind her and says, a dirty fighter. I like that. But if you run, you will leave me no choice. And so then he attacks her again, gets the drop on her, pins her down, and says, Ms. Pizzini, I just want to talk. And that's where the issue ends. So again, much like issue 5, not a whole lot of action in this issue until the last few pages. Clearly there's something going on. Clearly something has changed with Nottingham. You know, we saw when he attacked Sarah on Liberty Isle, he was willing and able to snap her neck, as he put it, and take the power of the Witchblade for himself. I don't know if it's this connection with her, that he's dreaming about her, something else has changed. So it ends on a bit of a cliffhanger with, okay, so what is he going to offer her? What does he have to say? What's changed? Is he just mad at Irons now? Is he going to throw Irons under the bus? Just don't know. So it's definitely well written. And in this issue, the other thing that really stood out is just how manipulative and evil Kenneth Irons is. He'll stop at nothing to get what he wants. And clearly he feels like he's above everyone. His arrogance is so self-evident, not in the way he talks to Sarah, but in the insight we get into his thoughts. It is a little weak on, as I said, the reasoning for helping Sarah. I mean, we know why he's doing it, because he wants to be able to control Sarah and the power of the Witchblade through her. But it's not obvious to Sarah why he's helping. And it would seem to me, being that she's a detective, that she would be very suspicious of this handsome, rich stranger that just shows up and offers his help for no other reason than he's going to offer his help. It doesn't make a lot of sense. As far as the artwork goes, you know, it's great Michael Turner art, fine detail, beautiful looking women, great expressions and panel layouts and layouts within the panels themselves. The storytelling is great. I mean, the scene where Sarah's walking to the park and she first gets the feeling that someone is there, you know, there's these wide, narrow panels that are just focused on her eyes, where they're kind of looking one way and looking the other way, and then hearing a gasp and the eyes go wide open. It's great storytelling, wonderful layout. So, you know, Michael Turner, people a lot of times talk about how beautiful his art was, what a great job he did. You know, people love the way he draws women, and what a great job he does with dynamic poses and stuff like that. I don't hear enough people talk about how good he was at expressions and having his characters emote with their face, and oftentimes without even showing the whole face. So that's definitely something that I want to point out, because, as I said, I think people don't realize, and they just think of him as kind of a pinup artist, so to speak. So that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Source Presents the Top Cow Chronology Project. Thanks for joining me. Please go to thecomicsourceblog.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Don't forget about our exclusive podcast with LRM Online, the 9-panel grid. Soon, all the Comic Source podcast content will be hosted over at lrmonline.com, and we'll be sure to let you know when that happens. As long as you're visiting us over at lrmonline.com, please take the time to look at their other pop culture coverage on things like TV, movies, video games, all that kind of great stuff. Also, Manny and I will be at WonderCon in Anaheim, California, coming up at the end of March. So stay tuned for more news about that. We're going to be doing some giveaways there. So you'll definitely want to take advantage of that. Twitter.com/TheComicSource is where you can find us on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us at those places and keep up to date with all our convention coverage and to find out when new episodes are released. So I really want to thank you all for joining me, and we'll talk to you next time.